Please call the case.
Case number SC-18-12-764, Verbach Beavis PH Corporation. Arguing for the appellants and cross appellees, Paul Austin. Also appearing for the appellants and cross appellees, John Reed. Arguing for the appellee and cross appellant, James Bickerton. Also appearing for the appellee and cross appellant, John Perkin and Randy Correa. Arguing on the merits.
Good morning, counsel. And both sides are ready to proceed? Okay. Just so we're clear, we're going to be beginning today with argument on behalf of the defendants, Mr. Alston, with regard to the appeal. You've reserved 15 minutes for that. So when you get 15 minutes in, we'll give you a yellow light, which will warn you that you're cutting into the remaining time that you've reserved for later. That'll be followed by Mr. Bickerton, who will be responding to that argument and arguing the plaintiff's cross appeal. Then Mr. Alston will come back again to respond on the cross-appeal, give any rebuttal with regard to the defendant's appeal. And finally, Mr. Bickerton's reserved 10 minutes regarding rebuttal on the cross-appeal. So again, Mr. Bickerton, we'll give you a light 20 minutes in on your first argument. That's agreeable to everyone. Please proceed, Mr. Alston.
Chief Justice Rechtenwald, Justices, may it please the Court. I am glad in some respects that we are here after your decision in Devon, because were it otherwise, I would spend a great deal of time this morning trying to persuade you that Chapter 388 does not create a remedy for employees. But now we know it does, and we now know that Section 481B14, which I'll call Section 14, is woven into the fabric of Chapter 388.
Mr. Alston? Could I ask that you bring the microphone up to you?
Sure.
Thank you.
Thank you. Sorry. We know that Section 14 is woven into the fabric of Chapter 388 in a way that means that when an employer fails to disclose, there is a full remedy immediately available to employees who do not receive 100% of the service charges. And by that I mean that what the court has now held is that under 388, if there is non-disclosure, the service charge belongs to the employees and needs to be distributed by the employer to the employees. So that the failure of disclosure gives employees the remedy of full payment. Now, in this case, we have a situation where the record indicates that except for approximately 107,000 or thereabouts, employees of the defendants, and by that I mean the plaintiff class, and I'll come back to the issue of who exactly was their employer, but the plaintiff class and other workers got all but $107,000. So what we face this morning are several issues now that the appeal has been streamlined by the issuance of your decision in Vallon. At the threshold, I feel compelled to raise the jurisdictional issue, which is addressed in page 5 and 6 of our opening brief, which is whether there was in fact a final judgment compliant that complied with the requirements of Jenkins v. Caves and Rule 58. It appears from this court's memorandum decision in the Nakaoka versus Hilton Hawaiian Village case that there was not a final judgment. Not that we seek a remand, not that we want more delay and more expense, but I know the court zealously guards its jurisdiction, and it's a point that deserves, I think, some attention by the court. But turning to the merits, the second point, the most important point here this morning, is the question whether Judge Sakamoto properly held the defendants liable for everything that wasn't distributed to what the plaintiffs and he characterized as being the service workers and people other than those in, quote, management. And the record shows that at both hotels, people besides the servers shared in the service charge that was imposed. At the Pacific Beach Hotel, that included low-level people involved in creating, planning, and putting on the events, such as the catering manager, the assistant catering manager, the catering coordinator, the food and beverage director, the stewarding manager, and the pastry chef.
Food and beverage director, you're calling a low-level employee in a hotel?
Well, I'm distinguishing them from the people in the executive suite who...
Food and beverage director is a management position in a hotel.
No question. But it is a management position that is occupied by somebody who is clearly directly engaged in creating and developing the events that lead to the service charge income for the hotel. And it may be, Your Honor, that within that group there are some who in some sense should not share, quote unquote, in the service fee income. But when the hotel decides that it wants to spread that service fee income among those responsible for creating, planning, putting on the event, not just the people who have direct action in the banquet room, that is certainly a reasonable judgment. It is a judgment the record shows is consistent with industry practice, and it is one that is not forbidden in any respect by the language of Section 14, which speaks only of employees. And if I could go back and finish, with respect to the Pagoda Hotel, the money was shared by the catering manager, the assistant manager, and the assistant head pantry person. Again, people involved in staging, in arranging, coordinating, and staging the event. And when the hotel decides to share, it is certainly not unreasonable to share with people who are involved in that way, as opposed to a much more difficult case where they say, we're going to share the service fee income with people who knew nothing, did nothing, and were not involved in any way.
Mr. Alston, 4A1B14 is very clear. Shall distribute the service charge directly to its employees as tip income.
Yes, Your Honor.
I'm sorry, but how do a catering manager and a food and beverage director get tip income?
Well, they get tip income because the employer decided that that's an appropriate way to allocate the income.
A food and beverage director in a hotel organization is right below the general manager.
Perhaps so.
So how far up do we go?
Well, again, I suggest that the line is drawn at people who are involved in arranging and coordinating and putting on the event. And that would include the food and beverage manager. Now, I would also note that as this court said in Davis, the reference to tip income, I'm sorry, not in Davis, in Vallon. As this court said in Vallon, the reference to tip income was not found in the early draft of what became Section 14. It was added later, and as you said in Vallon, it was a technical, non-substantive amendment which indicated or which demonstrated that the legislature was using the phrase, quote, as tip income, as shorthand, as a term that was synonymous with wages and tips. And so you've already addressed this question in Vallon and said that the reference to tip income was just technical shorthand, not a substantive restriction. It's also clear that industry practice would indicate that sharing with people with whom a customer does not have direct contact, people behind the scenes, which would include the pantryman, the coordinator, the pastry chef, you know, people who make it a good event, although they're not seen, if you will, can fairly be given an allocation. And so I don't think it's a question of being, of looking.
Mr. Alston, I'm just wondering, so what does this lead to? Are you talking about class certification? Are you talking about
the damages?
Double payment or what?
I'm talking about two things, Your Honor. I'm talking about the damages, because the judge found, Judge Sakamoto held that everything that didn't go to what he and the plaintiffs characterized as service workers was fairly part of the damages to be reallocated to them.
So your argument is that at least some of the damages awarded by the judge should be rescinded because those damages would go to the people you've described?
Because that money did go to the people we described. The record shows that there was a time when there were vacancies in various positions at the hotels when money was not allocated and was kept in the accounting department, or kept by the accounting department. That's about $107,000. As to that, I have to agree that in light of Vallon, there is a claim for $107,000, or thereabouts. The exact amount is not, it's not something I can give you today. But with respect to the other money that the employer didn't keep, you can't, I submit, draw a bright line between, quote, service workers and all of management.
But isn't this a consumer protection statute? It's in the consumer protection law. Wouldn't the relevant criteria be what a reasonable consumer might understand in terms of who the recipients of the service charge would be? And to the extent there's any doubt or gray area, wouldn't the gist of the statute seem to be that there should have been disclosure so that the customer could understand what he or she was paying for?
Well, the gist of the statute is if there isn't disclosure, there has to be a distribution. And under
well, you're arguing what the hotel did was perfectly reasonable. And if what is perfectly reasonable, why not just disclose so the customers understand what they're getting?
You know, in retrospect, I think every hotel in the state, except perhaps Starwood, which complied, regrets not having disclosed. People have paid a lot of money to workers. And the question here is, to whom the money should be paid? Should it be paid only to people that the plaintiffs choose to characterize as service workers, or does the hotel have discretion to say, anybody who helped put on this event and make it a success should share in the
then why shouldn't housekeeping share?
Why doesn't the housekeeping?
Why shouldn't the entire hotel share?
Maybe so, Your Honor. Maybe so. But I think that.
Isn't that the difficulty, though, with your argument? There's no cutoff. I mean, it could be maintenance people.
I think, Your Honor, the argument is not so open-ended that way. I am saying if there are reasons to believe that it is shared among people who coordinated and put on the event and made it successful, like the pastry chef, that's an appropriate allocation by the employer. And there is nothing in section 14 that demonstrates that it's limited to a group that plaintiff's lawyers would later say should be favored over other people who were equally involved in the process of making the event successful.
Shouldn't the same people get it if instead of the hotel taking it and reserving, if the hotel didn't do it, shouldn't the same people, it should be the same people who would get it whether you reserved it or not?
Yes, then the question comes, are there tip pooling arrangements? I mean, does the money always go only to the person who happens to be first to the dirty table after the event's over and grabs and scoops the money, or are there tip pooling arrangements? This is in effect an institutionalized tip pooling arrangement, and it's nothing more than that. And again, I would not. This would be a very hard argument, and one I would not make if we were talking about the CEO or somebody in the plush executive office.
It may be that you need guidance from this court, but is that more or less a fact question?
Yes.
As to, what is the custom? Well, I think the irrespective of the statute, as to how tip money was allocated or distributed.
I think it is fairly presented as a fact question. I mean, it's fairly presented as the trial court not going against the evidence that we provided of industry custom and saying these are the people that they choose to represent who are the only ones who can share. So let me turn, if I could, briefly to my other points. With respect to class certification, we know from the complaint that Mr. Gerbot worked at the Pacific Beach Hotel. We know from the complaint that, quote, other class members worked at the Pagoda. We've raised the question whether a class should have been certified covering both hotels and demonstrated that this is an issue of standing that Judge Sakamoto had an independent duty to evaluate, and we suggest, and the record I think shows, that there was a lack of evidence tying these hotels together, given that they had different distribution policies with respect to who shared in the amount. I'll leave it at that. My time is short. Next point is very briefly the issue of joint and several liability. The possibility of joint and several liability was never briefed in any motion. It was never argued in connection with any motion. It is inserted first into the proposed final judgment that is presented to the court by the plaintiffs. My client, through former counsel, objects, saying, wait a minute, this isn't an issue. This hasn't been briefed. There's no evidence to establish that the Pacific Beach Corporation, which operates and employs people at the Pacific Beach Hotel, can be held jointly and severally liable for what happens at the other hotel, the Pagoda, which it doesn't have any role in. And it cited the evidence in the record to that effect. And the final judgment gets entered imposing joint and several liability. That implicates, obviously, due process questions, but it also implicates the question of whether there's anything in chapter 388 which would impose liability on someone when there is not evidence of their direct employer relationship.
Is the record, if judgment should not have been imposed upon Pacific Beach Hotel for undistributed tip income for the Pagoda, is the record very clear as to which amount, what the separate amounts were?
It is, Your Honor. In the objections filed on January 6, 2012, there is a statement of what damages are attributable to each hotel.
Okay. The record indicates that Pagoda Inc. was the employer of the Pagoda employees, and Pacific Beach Hotel was the employer.
Pacific Beach Corporation.
Sorry. Of the Pacific Beach employees. So does the fact that HTH had, I guess, operational supervision over in both hotels make a difference with respect to joint and several liability?
Well, it does with respect to the joint and several liability for the Pagoda issue. Whether HTH is liable for both hotels as the owner of both hotels, in the absence of evidence that it actually was the employer, when the evidence shows there were W-2s coming to employees from the Pacific Beach Corporation and Pagoda Hotel Inc., I think is an open question. The plaintiffs would have you believe that this is like horseshoes and dancing. If they get close enough to a corporation, it's enough to impose liability. And simply saying that they had some operational influence or operational control isn't the same as saying that they were the person actually, or the entity actually permitting or suffering Mr. Gurabat and others to work. We know they weren't issuing the W-2s. And there is not evidence that HTH was ever actually engaged in deciding who to hire, who to fire, what work to give them, or anything of that nature. The record, I confess, and I have to acknowledge that my prior counsel was not as either as clear or as diligent as perhaps it could have and should have been with respect to drawing these lines and pointing out the deficiencies.
HTH is the owner of both hotels?
Indeed, Your Honor.
And operates both hotels?
It is. It was identified at various points as operating a hotel.
But the employer in Pagoda is Pagoda Inc.
Correct.
And Pacific Beach Corporation.
That's correct.
For Pacific Beach Hotel.
That's correct, Your Honor. And so, you know, what the plaintiffs would have you believe is that they get the benefit of sort of instant veil piercing. They instantly get to go up the corporate ladder. Even if it's only a question of operation as opposed to suffering or permitting people to work. My time is up, so I'm going to leave my rest.
Thank you very much, Mr. Alston. Mr. Bickerton.
Justice, honorable justices of the court, may it please the court. I think a good place to start would be to pick up where Justice Acoba asked the question about Pagoda Inc. One of the federal cases we cite has actually addressed this. I think it was Judge Gilmore. And she pointed out that under a long line of federal labor law cases, but also under her own analysis of this statute, employer doesn't mean the entity that produces a W-2 form. Hotels like to do that because they can set up little shell companies whose only job is to cut the W-2 and has no assets that could be attached or secured in the event of a judgment. So what the law says the definition of employer is in Chapter 387 or 388, I think it's 388 actually, says it is anyone who suffers or permits someone to work. And the case law is very clear. You can have multiple employers. In other words, if two or three entities together operate a hotel, and they're together making the concerted decision about where to allocate resources, where to send the workers, what tasks to give them, they are suffering or permitting the work, and they are all employees and employers of the employees. So we really can't get too focused on was it Pagoda in here or someone else there. Now, they admitted in the answer that HTH owns and operates both hotels, and this is Mr. Alston suggested his former counsel had a different approach than he did. I would say yes, he wasn't picking nits because he wasn't driving in his rearview mirror. He was fighting the case at the time. These are side issues. They are small issues. They are issues that are easily addressed if raised. People who make tactical decisions to not fight certain issues have the inability.
When was this issue raised in the first instance?
This issue was raised on reconsideration.
Right, not at the time of the original motion, right?
Yes. And I would suggest it's not really a problem with the judgment. There's a suggestion that we never told them that this was joint and several. The class definition is where this comes from. The class definition is the employees of both hotels. I don't want to jump around too much, but I want to make the additional point. When you come after the fact and seek reconsideration, one of the considerations that you look at is the injustice of letting it stand. Because if we allow people to constantly relitigate issues that have already been settled or decided, you end up where Mr. Gurabat is. 5 years after he filed suit, 9 years after he earned these tips that were taken from him, he still has not been paid. And I challenge Mr. Alston. He says people have paid a lot of dollars other than Starwood. Well, actually, no one's been paying anything. Two cases of these 16 have settled because they keep thinking of new reasons why the plain language of these statutes doesn't apply. And that's exactly what the new counsel have done. They've gone back and combed through the record to find things. So you have to ask yourself, is there some great injustice here? Have they told you that HTH has no connection to to Pacific Beach? Does one own the other? If one hotel company owns the other hotel company, and the parent company owns and operates both and allows its subsidiary to operate the other, well, no wonder they didn't whine about it back when it was at issue, but now they have to find something to say after the
fact. Mr. Bickerton, what about Mr. Alston's argument that it was appropriate to, or within the contemplation of the statute, to pay portions of the service charge to managerial employees?
I have both procedural points about that and very substantive ones. First of all, it's not in the brief. This is a point we actually make at 17 and 18. We wondered, they made that argument below. And I think that the new lawyers recognized that it had been very unsuccessful, it's unpersuasive. The questions you asked are the right questions, and I'll give you the substantive answers to those questions in a moment. But there's only one spot in their entire brief where they allude to it. It's not in the points, but in the argument they refer back to it. They were really focusing on this point that they tried to argue in Billon, which is there's no earning going on. The workers are not earning the tip. And so they said, well, they didn't earn the part that went to the managers. That's it. They refer, I think that's at pages 17 and 18 of their opening brief. It's not in the points of error. And that was one of the complaints we had. They did not quote from the ruling by Judge Sakamoto, so we would know that they were actually questioning, because that was a specific ruling that he made.
But have we addressed this issue in Vermont? Didn't we make clear that first the statute 450, 481B14 says that the hotels and restaurants shall distribute the service charge directly to its employees as tip income. In the alternative, the statute permits hotels and restaurants to use service wages to pay for costs or expenses other than wages and tips of employees, provided that hotels and restaurants clearly disclose. There was no disclosure that this was not being used as tip income here.
Your Honor,
isn't that the issue here?
Yes, I think so. But bear in mind, when I get to my portion of the argument on my appeal, one of my points is that you folks can say things and think this is clear, and then others, especially those who are well paid to think of other interpretations, will take those if you give them leeway. So perhaps it does need to be clarified. And let me suggest some points that will help you do that. The first thing is we extensively briefed this to Judge Sakamoto, and one filing, I don't have the docket number of the filing in front of me, but it's our October 25, 2010 memorandum. And we went through a lot of the legislative history of the statute. And one of the committee reports that Justice McKenna cited in the recent DeLong decision, and it's quoted in DeLong, it specifically says the service employees. So if the term employees is ambiguous, and let's say that's the best that Mr. Alston can argue, when you have the frame that there's tip income that has to go to somebody, if it's ambiguous, then let's look at the legislative history, and you'll see that committee report talks about the service employees. And as Justice Reckonwald points out, the whole idea was based on who does the consumer think is getting the tip. And the real test for whether there's any sense to their argument is not, well, this is a practice that we did, and we were doing it, so therefore it was right. That can't be the law. You can't let the hotel do that. I mean, they could, for example, say, well, you know, really, when you get right down to it, isn't the CEO the guy who really makes everything happen at the end of the day? And ultimately, he's responsible for the banquet, so let's give the whole tip to him.
Is there anything in the record as to how they delineated who was going to get it? Do you actually have to be there at the time? Somebody just okays it?
Yes, it's the people who actually render service, and those are categories of employees that are well recognized in the industry, such as if you're a busboy, a waiter, bartender, and that is in the record.
No, I mean what Mr. Alston is arguing about.
They did list who was getting it. They did list the managers who were sharing. What they were doing, there's a long history to this. What you need to know is this is one of the few hotels that got sued that is a non-union hotel. I think that may have changed. I haven't followed that issue. They may be union now. But the other hotels in collective bargaining agreed to let the hotels keep 15% and 85% goes to the workers, so long, of course, as the law is complied with and disclosure is made. So they were following industry practice in the sense that the hotel was keeping 15% or 17%, depending on whether it was the Pagoda or the Pacific Beach. But the decision of how to spend that, that's made at each hotel, how they spend it. Some hotels will spend it on new cutlery and forks and, you know, things like that. Others may give money to managers, but it's not reaching the service workers. But the question I would ask everyone to think about is, where tip is not compelled, like when we all go out and have dinner at the Pacific Beach Hotel, which has a lovely restaurant with a big aquarium, most of us have been there, and we buy dinner for us, and we leave a tip, does the manager get that? You know, there's no record evidence from them of that, and I would suspect that if that was happening, there would be probably riots somewhere, but it just doesn't happen that way. So you can't invent a special rule for banquets and say, well, in banquets we're going to tip all of these managers because we can. The legislature has said that it's a service charge. Heatherly says, and I know that in Villon you felt Heatherly didn't apply much to that case, and I recognize why, but it does apply to this question. It says the tip belongs to the person who renders the service. You start with that. So who rendered the service is the person who gets the tip income. I think that's all clear and implicit in Villon, but I would ask this court to make it clear here. Otherwise, we will be going back for another few years. We have two consumer cases that are still pending in the ICA. They were filed in 2008. I think the hope of the hotels is that these cases will be remanded back down, another year or two of skirmishing, and then maybe another 3 years in the ICA. Maybe we'll be fortunate enough to ride the coattails of yet another certified question back to this court. Maybe not. But that's what they're doing, and these are workers who have waited a long time. And I know that shouldn't enter into your calculation. You are here as the body deciding the ultimate questions of law, and the impatience of people shouldn't really enter into your equations. But I do think when the arguments are being made in reconsideration after the fact, and that's all but one of their points is that way, that you do have to examine the justice of their position in deciding whether or not to revisit those issues.
Which point was it that they actually raised originally rather than in reconsideration?
The one that you decided in DeLong. So frankly, I think there's nothing left of their appeal that really can't be decided on procedural grounds. They were arguing that there is no cause of action under Chapter 388 for recovery of.
What about the question of joint and several liability? What does that go to?
Well, first of all, we have admissions in the record that each of them owned and operated both hotels, and they're trying to evade that by saying, well, that was a mistake, or that was in a settlement conference statement. They don't. It's important to understand what a settlement conference statement is. It is not a Rule 408 offer. It's not some admission of liability that is made in the course of saying, I'm sorry, and therefore can't be admitted. Under Rule 12.1 of the Circuit Court rules, a settlement conference statement is a specific publicly filed document that gives the court the background, and one of the things is who are the parties. Mr. Gurabat has to say, I'm 50-something years old, and I'm a hotel worker, and the defense has to say I'm a corporation, I operate this hotel. And in that statement to the judge, they said both entities operate both hotels. That was the state of the record then. And now they're saying, well, Pacific Beach doesn't. But we also have pointed in our brief to other evidence that was before Judge Sakamoto that the guys at the Pagoda, they report back to the guy at the Pacific Beach Hotel. They're completely intertwined. You have to also look at, I was mentioning the point earlier that this is really a class definition issue. We got a class definition. They opposed class certification and raised a number of issues which they have now abandoned, and they're arguing all the new issues that Mr. Alston has seen. But the class certification question is, we have a group of employees who have a common owner-operator, which is HTH. They're entitled to be in one class. You can't say, well, there's got to be another representative from the other hotel. It's the same company that owns and operates both hotels, HTH. One worker can represent both hotels' workers. And they've never presented any evidence that he did not work at the Pagoda. It's very common for employees in Waikiki to move from hotel to hotel. But so we have no problem. HTH is liable for both. The question he's saying is, well, Pacific Beach shouldn't be liable for the Pagoda. But bear in mind that members of this class that was defined and certified include the Pacific Beach employees. They're one mass. And the Pacific Beach harmed those employees. With respect to the class, there is joint and several liability. And the fact is that that's how our motion was phrased. It says the plaintiff class, certified class, moves for judgment against the defendants. So we have a situation where, yes, you're jointly and severally liable to the class. Perhaps, as between yourselves, you can sort out who owes what. But to the class, they're jointly and severally liable. One entity, they argue, did not injure everyone in the class.
You're saying Mr. Gurabat can be a class representative for the employees at Pagoda?
Absolutely. And the hypothetical we give in the brief is, for example, suppose that someone at Hawaii Kai Costco was a victim of a practice where they're doing right now, I think, at Walmart. They make people wait to go through a security check after they've clocked out, and they have to spend 20 minutes in the security line that they're not compensated for. That's a mainland class action. That's Walmart right now. a representative from the Hawaii Kai Costco, and I don't mean to denigrate Costco, I love the place, and they probably would never do this, but as a hypothetical, he comes forward and he says, I want to represent all the Costco employees, the ones in Aiea, the ones on the neighbor islands, who are experiencing the same thing from the same employer. Mr. Alston would probably try at some point to say, well, he can only represent the guys at that store, and you got to get another representative from the other stores. But what would be the reason for that when it's the same employer owning and operating all the stores?
Mr. Bickerton, could you move on to the 480 question?
Thank you, Your Honor. I would like to do that very much. They're actually tied together because Mr. Alston's first remark was to tell you that there is a full remedy. And I knew that that's where they would go with this. They would say, gee, you're getting double damages. Why do you need treble damages? Well, the answer is because the law requires it. And actually, the real practical answer is because I'm standing here 5 years after we filed these suits and 9 years after these tips were earned. Why is that relevant? Because treble damages, the function and purpose of treble damages is to level the playing field when you have consumers and workers and people of that nature dealing with large corporate interests. We say, you know what? You can string people out forever if you're just paying single or even perhaps double damages. We're going to make you pay treble and your cases will settle. I've been handling Chapter 480 cases for over 20 years and only one has actually gone to judgment where we actually got awarded treble damages. The cases settle. It's the function of the statute. And interestingly enough, we didn't collect that judgment. We settled after judgment to avoid an appeal, and they paid double instead of treble. So that's the function of the statute. And if we had treble damages, we might not have this endless, let me think of another reason why the plain language of this statute doesn't apply. Let's pick apart the last decision of the Supreme Court and find something else.
You come up with this theory of unfair competition versus, yes. I guess, the antitrust injury concept of reducing competition. Is there any authority for a concept like unfair competition?
Very much so, Your Honor. Starting with Island Tobacco, there's a little funny history with this statute in this court. It's not this particular court, but in the prior court, they actually decided there was no private right of action under 480-2 for what we'll call UMOCs, unfair methods of competition. And then the legislature the next year said, well, there is, and passed a law making it so. And the court, I think it was Justice Ramil in the Roberts case, was the one who wrote that opinion. And they came back later and said, well, the legislature is creating a new right that didn't previously exist. But if you're really brutally honest about it, and you go back and you read Island Tobacco and a number of other cases, there was a private right of action. It wasn't questioned. Since 2002, it can't be questioned, but the defense still tries to find ways. Whatever pronouncement you make, they will try to find a way to parse it out. And that's what they did. Honestly, I had to read Davis several times before I came to the conclusion that's in my reply memo, which is, you know, it really doesn't say what many judges thought it said. It spoke a lot about antitrust, but it isn't abolishing the UMOC right. The case law is very clear. And Island Tobacco says it crystal clear. It says unfair methods of competition is about more than just ordinary antitrust injury. And it says,
well, I think that's true in, of 481B. But
it protects competitors and competition.
Well, I think 481B was intended to protect employees and consumers. It doesn't say anything about competition among hotels. But I wanted to ask you, you know, the trial court said it would grant summary judgment to the defendants on the basis that there could be no evidence at trial that there was any actual injury that resulted from the hotels not complying with law. and that all the plaintiffs could come up with would be hypothetical, a hypothetical law-compliant hotel, as posed by your two experts. Is it possible to posit that there is a antitrust injury through the use of a hypothetical in the absence of actual injury to any existing hotel?
Well, we do address that in the brief. We think that if everyone has been driven out of fairly competing, if nobody is fairly competing, does that mean that there's no antitrust problem? But again, I really, the point of our appeal is the word antitrust injury has been used too loosely, and it shouldn't be used in this case. It was used by analogy in Davis to show that the causal link between the offense of violating the statute and the harm, they have to fit together under the statutory scheme, and that's what antitrust cases say about antitrust injury. And what I believe this court was saying in Davis is if you have a UMOC violation, then it should be a UMOC type injury, and that's why Justice Rechtenwald's opinion requires you've got to show that there is some competition in the picture. But I think that's as far as it goes, because what, for example, the Ostroff case says, that's a Ninth Circuit case where there was a boycott, and an employee was fired by his employer for not participating in the boycott, and he sued under the antitrust laws. And of course, the defense said, well, this is not a classic antitrust injury. You're not a consumer. You're not a competitor. You didn't have your prices fixed. But they said he was the fulcrum. He was the thing that they used to achieve their end. And so he was directly harmed by the violation, and therefore he had standing, he had injury, he had the requisite injury, and they followed the Blue Shield analysis. And that's what we ask here. We're saying the exact fulcrum or tip of the spear that they use to outcompete compliant hotels is to grab the worker's tip. He's directly injured. That is all you need to do. That's all Davis really required. But because Davis went on for several pages explaining the analogous system in antitrust, many judges have said, gee, you've got to prove that prices were reduced. You've got to prove that hotels, that prices were increased. Well, we can't meet that burden.
If we agree with you, what remedy are you requesting?
We are actually simply requesting that the judgment that was entered, instead of the application of 2x + 6%, which is under 388, simply be 3x. And it's a math exercise. I know in the brief.
And you think you're entitled to summary judgment as a matter of law on 480?
We do. I know in the brief we said it should be remanded to Judge Sakamoto to finish the job. But as I read, I was reading the Kinker versus Bauer case, and it says if the matter wasn't addressed by the circuit court, but if it's a pure question of law that you can apply to the record and no further factual inquiry is required, and it's in the interest of justice, this court can just make that ruling without even a remand. And that's something that we would ask the court to do. But there's a larger reason. I do want to reserve a few minutes for rebuttal, but there's a larger reason why it's important. If you read not only the hotel cases where they interpreted Davis in this very narrow way to really give no more rights than a monopoly cause of action.
Exactly. Hasn't the law been interpreted so that 481B for the remedies is just, it doesn't offer anything?
Well, 481B sends you to 48013,
right.
And the UMOC section of that has now been taken by trial judges. No appellate judge has agreed with them yet, but trial judges are now saying, well, we read Davis as requiring an injury to competition. But it's a UMOC case. It's about injury to fair competition or injury to competitors. And I think that if you read Davis carefully, it's absolutely consistent with that. But if you just sort of grab quotes out of a case, which is what people tend to do, you can pull quotes out of Davis that are talking about antitrust injury. But the court itself never said there must be a true antitrust injury, a reduction in competition. HMA didn't involve reduction in competition, and you upheld a UMOC claim there. So the problem is, if you look at the case of Blue Earth Biofuels, and there's another case by Judge Kobayashi in federal court that cited the Helicu case, it's a mortgage case, you'll see the judges, this is creeping now, where UMOC cases are basically dying on the vine. Because in many cases, an unfair practice is not going to cause prices to rise. Unfair practices actually can cause prices to drop because the guy who's cheating and saving all the money by not doing the following all the regs is actually getting cost savings and everyone's having to compete with him. They're trying to comply with the law and they can't. So prices aren't going up. There's not a monopoly problem. 480-4, 480-9 don't help. 480-2 helps. And it sends you to 480-13, and that's how you have to do the analysis. Is there an injury to a competitor? And we suggest that there is. And to answer Justice Bacoba's question, the injury to competitors can be hypothetical. You don't have to produce a particular entity, but you have to produce someone who's hurt by an unfair practice. And the person who's hurt is Mr. Gurabat and the other 167 members of the class. That judgment works out to about $10,000 per employee.
Have you gone through 481B to figure out whether or not an injury to a competitor can be met by all of those statutes that are deemed unfair methods of competition?
We actually did that in the lower court. There's a whole raft of things that are deemed by 481B to be UDAPs and UMOCs.
Right.
Some are interestingly only deemed to be UDAPs, I think, but in 481B4, they're deemed to be UMOCs, and some of them, you'd have a very remote connection to competition. The legislature took care of that in the deeming, and with the greatest respect to Justice Rechtewald, I'm not disagreeing with his Davis opinion, but we must find some room somewhere for the deeming language to operate, and I suggest it works here. It's like, I should not have to, a worker may have only lost $500. He's entitled to go to court and say, I want my 500 bucks, I want it under 481B and 480-13, and I shouldn't have to hire Andre Taddy-Bouet and Paul Brubaker to get it, because the legislature said it's an unfair method of competition, and they deemed it to be so, and that's good enough. As long as I can show I'm injured by it, I get my treble damages, and the fact that they have to pay treble damages means I probably will never have to go to court. They'll just pay me single or double damages and we'll be settled. That's how it should work, and we ask this court to write its opinion away to make sure the system does work that way. Thank you. I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Thank you, Mr. Bickerton. Mr. Alston.
Thank you, Your Honor. First, I'd like to begin by withdrawing my comments about the final judgment. Despite brain thrust, Mr. Reed reminded me that the initial appeal was dismissed. There was an amended judgment, so that's a non-issue. But Mr. Bickerton's point about the one issue that was raised before the motion for reconsideration is simply wrong. He tells you that the only thing that was in the third point, which is the one he admits at page 12 of his answering brief, was properly raised before reconsideration, is specifically directed to this issue about who shares. On page 8 of our opening brief, we said, among other things, the circuit court incorrectly held that this plaintiff class was entitled to the portion of the service charge that defendants already paid to management employees. So this issue was both timely raised and directly raised as our third point of error, and it raises the question as a point of fact. If, in fact, any employees who are involved in creating and putting on an event are not entitled to share under Section 14, then who are they? Perhaps going to Judge McKenna's point, the banquet manager, the food and beverage manager, is too high in the chain to qualify. But the pastry chef, the assistant pantry man, the others who are in the bowels of the organization making these things success to make people happy, at some point, even though people are called management, they are involved in the very important job of making people happy with these events, and it is certainly appropriate for the hotel to decide, in line with industry custom, that they want people to be rewarded for making happy customers. Let me turn, if I could, to the 480-point. that 40-2 argument. From all that appeared up until this morning, Mr. Bickerton was trying to parlay double damages together with treble damages and get quintuple damages. I now hear him saying he only wants the higher of the two, and he'll be happy with only treble damages. The problem with his argument is just this. When a hotel fails to make disclosure and therefore attracts business from other hotels, they are in fact causing, arguably, or at least theoretically, competitive harm, but not to their own employees. What they're doing is causing competitive harm to the other hotels that are losing business because they're being underbid. They're causing competitive harm to the employees at those other hotels, at least in theory. But their own employees are in fact the beneficiaries of the non-disclosure, because when Chapter 388 provides the immediate remedy of full payment of the entirety of the service charges to the appropriate group of employees.
So what remedy would there be under 41B14?
I think that, at least in theory, if the proof was all there, you would have a hotel that lost business on the basis of non-disclosure. You would have employees of other hotels who lost business saying, wait a minute, I'm sitting here like the proverbial
matron. So the employee of the hotel that engaged in the UMOC would not have standing to raise a 41?
No, because they are not injured by the unfair competition.
In other words, they would never be able to prove causation.
They would never be able to prove an injury that comes directly from the unfair competition. And I say that because under Vallon, when there is a non-disclosure, they get the service charge. So they cannot have been injured by the unfair competition because 388 triggers a right of payment. And
so,
in appropriate cases, double damages.
Sorry. So, Mr. Alston,
yes,
we have the situation where the experts can only hypothetically predict what would happen in an environment where there's a law-compliant hotel.
Right.
So what's happened, I guess, in the industry is no one complies with the law,
and therefore no
one's injured. And so then you don't have an anti-competitive effect because no one follows the law.
Well, I think...
I mean, so should we sanction that and confirm that by saying, okay, there's no anti-competitive effect. What the legislature said provides a, I guess, sets out a violation, but there's no remedy because we can't trace an injury suffered by the hotels.
Well,
is that the situation we would be left in?
No, Your Honor. For two reasons. One is that the plaintiffs point out that they provided evidence that Starwood Hotels was compliant, that Starwood Hotels did make disclosure. So it wasn't a theory. It wasn't purely a hypothetical. But I
think they sort of qualified that, or the experts qualified that.
Well, but the evidence put into the record includes menus and banquet order forms where there is a disclosure by Starwood. So you have that evidence that is not a scofflaw industry in its entirety. But the other point, Your Honor, is that this court has recognized that the injury to be compensable under Chapter 480, the injury has to flow from the illegal conduct, the improper conduct. And where an employee of the hotel that gains business is actually getting more work and more tips because their employer has done something bad in this hypothetical.
I think Mr. Alston makes the argument the employees are working harder and not getting what they're entitled to under the law.
Yes, but that's remedied directly and immediately by Chapter 388.
But what remedy would an employee have? Under what circumstances could an employee recover?
For a
480, yes.
Okay. You could have the employees of hotel number one, which has no business, no banquet business, because they're being undercut by hotel number two, could have a claim if they could demonstrate.
But the employees of the hotel where the service charge is being withheld or paid to someone other than the employees would not have a claim, ever, under any circumstance.
I cannot conceive of one because, as Vallon says, if the hotel doesn't comply, they immediately are entitled to the entire service charge. So the non-disclosure hasn't caused them harm. In fact, the non-disclosure has given them more than they bargained for, more than the hotel practiced, more than the hotel actually distributed in reality, perhaps. And so, you know, the remedy then comes, or the harm then comes, from the hotel's violation of Chapter 388 by not paying the money over. It doesn't come from the failure to disclose the service charge allocation policy to a consumer.
You know, Mr. Olson, if we accept your argument, it seems to me that could be an argument to inferentially to re-examine Davis.
No, and for this reason. The problem is there is a long history where Rawlins is a good example, where you could have conduct which is a UMOC, you could have conduct which is a UDAP that doesn't harm the plaintiff coming forward. Okay? They may be harmed by something, or they may not be harmed at all, but not everybody in the world who is at least in theory benefited by the wrongful conduct can come and say, I happen to be in the vicinity of someone who caused competitive harm to another person, and because I'm in this vicinity, I have a remedy. If the law had been decided differently, and you had decided that nothing in Chapter 388 provides a full payment remedy, I would be in a very different position than where I am today, because then I would be having to say, gee, too bad, no employee has any remedy, excuse me. But the reality is you've now said if the Pacific Beach Hotel didn't disclose, what happens is they get all the money. They get all the service charge.
But then that would be ignoring 481B, I guess, 4, which specifically references a violation of 481B14
right.
as being remedied under 480-2.
Right, and for those who suffer some harm as a result of the unfair competition.
So what I'm saying is 388 is not necessarily a substitute for a remedy under 480-2, because the legislature expressly made the remedy available under 480-2.
Indeed it did. It made the remedy available to people who are harmed by the unfair competition.
So Vallon would not, by reference to 388, preclude this court from considering additional or remedies under 480-2.
If someone has a remedy under 388, by definition, they have not been harmed by the lack of disclosure. But others may well have been. Others may well have been harmed. And so when the legislature said a violation of 481B14 is unfair competition and subject to a remedy, they didn't say it's subject to a remedy in favor of everybody in the universe. It's subject to a remedy. Those who were harmed as a result of the unfair competition have remedies. Those who were harmed by the employer's failure to pay wages, which 388-6 says belong to the employees, is not a harm that comes from the unfair competition. It comes from the failure to honor obligations under Chapter 388. So what I'm saying is you have to distinguish people who are not suffering harm because of the lack of disclosure, but you have to look at who's suffering harm because of the unfair competition itself.
Does 481B4 titled remedies say unless there's another remedy under 388? In other words, does this statute say it doesn't apply if there's a remedy under 388?
No. But...
But that's your response, in a sense.
No, my response is nothing in Chapter 481B says that it creates a remedy in favor of the universe. And when people are not harmed by the results of unfair competition, as opposed to harmed by the failure to comply with Chapter 388, that's what causes the employee's harm in this case, is the failure to comply with 388. It's not the lack of disclosure. The lack of disclosure, in fact, creates a substantial windfall in favor of the employees, because by failing to disclose, regardless of what they may have been actually getting, they now get the right to share in all the service charge. So they're not harmed by the lack of disclosure. They benefit from the lack of disclosure.
Mr. Alston, you can have a minute or two to wrap up if
yes,
you need.
Again, I think that the cases all teach that under Chapter 480, there has to be an injury that flows from the competition or the unfair competition or the unfair and deceptive act.
If that's true, then that's fine. But 481B says that a violation is deemed to be UMOC or UDAP, so that the legislature has already said that there is a violation and therefore a remedy is available under 480-2, which doesn't really require then, at least in my reading, a determination of the fact that there's been a violation of competition.
And you've been very consistent in taking that position in both Davis and Ballon. The problem, Your Honor, is that in 480-13, in order to establish a right to a monetary remedy, the plaintiff has to show that they suffered damage, quote, by reason of the UMOC, the unfair method of competition. From the standpoint of a worker who at the Pacific Beach.
Yeah, and I guess my position is that they have established that simply because the legislature already deemed it UMOC. So they have shown injury by reason of the violation. Because I think it's fairly obvious that if they're entitled to tip income and are not given tip income that they're entitled to, then that clearly they've suffered injury to their property as a result of the violation.
Yeah. But as would suggest, Your Honor, that's the position you took in dissent in both Davis
well,
and Ballon.
You know, I think that it's not necessary that, we look to federal, the federal part of the, I'm sorry, the federal background under 480, because there is no federal analog to 481. B14. I mean, we don't have the same kind of statute on the federal side.
Correct.
So I think in that situation, I think our statute controls, and we don't need to look at the federal anti-competition statutes or case law.
Well, and I would agree that 481B14 is unique. There is no federal analog, but that only carries you so far, and I submit that it carries you back into Section 480-13, where a plaintiff must prove not only that they suffered some damage to their business or property, but also that the damage to their business or property was by reason of the unfair method of competition. What the record shows and what the plaintiffs argued below is that the unfair method of competition results in the, what I'll call the bad hotel, getting more business. 388 says if the hotel draws bad business, all the money belongs to the employees. All the service charge money belongs to the employees. So that in fact, the day the event is held, by operation of 388, the employees are entitled to be made whole by 388. And the harm that comes is from the employer's failure to recognize that and failure to comply with 388. If they fail to comply with 388, they're exposed to double damages. But it's not It is not the unfair competition that drew the business to the hotel that caused the injury. It's the employer's failure to pay.
Mr. Alston, if part of the tip income is reserved by the employee to use to pay for operational expenses?
That would be the problem.
Clearly the hotel then has fewer expenses that they are paying themselves because they're adding tip. If they can lower their costs, how does that not affect competition?
It does affect competition. But from the standpoint of the employees of that hotel, it affects competition in a favorable way. Because if, for example, a hotel...
Taking money out of their pocket and giving it to, using it to pay for linen or salaries for other people...
Right, that is a problem. If they've done that, that is clearly a violation of 41B14. And if there wasn't disclosure, it's clearly a violation of Chapter 388. And in our case, we've acknowledged that there was about $107,000 where that happened. And we're not suggesting that the hotel isn't responsible for reallocating that to the appropriate employees. But that misallocation wasn't the consequence of the unfair competition.
What the plaintiffs say it exact. Their argument is that it absolutely is, which it flows from the act, which is uncompetitive, or that's subversive of a fair marketplace. What's your response to that?
My response is that to the other hotels and to the workers at other hotels who were injured in that way, if they can demonstrate that they in fact lost business, there is definitely a remedy because the hotel that won the business in effect. Arguably and hypothetically cheated, all right? And that hurt some people, all right? But when the hotel that won the business is obligated by 388 to pay it over and fails to do that, its failure to pay it over isn't the consequence of the unfair competition. It's a consequence of its disregard for 388. And if it disregarded 388 and did it in a way that was without an equitable justification, it's double damages plus interest. It has exactly the kind of deterrent effect that Mr. Bickerton is seeking.
Mr. Alston, can I ask? I'm still trying to explore the interrelationship between 41B and 480. And okay, so
sorry,
we're talking about 41B14, which is deemed a UMOC under 41B4, mm-hmm. which says, you know, UMOC and a UDAF, and then you go to 482 and you go to 4013. But as I asked Mr. Bickerton, you know, there's a lot of other statutes under 41B that are deemed UMOCs. Okay, and I'm looking at one, 41B7, sale of computers, disclosure requirements. And basically, you know, at a simple level, it says, no person shall sell a computer from which any manufacturer's part has been removed or replaced unless the person discloses in writing that. To the consumer, and it says, and then under 481B4, that would also be a UMOC. Okay, so let's say I replace a hard drive, and I sell my computer to a friend, and I don't disclose in writing that I replaced the hard drive. I have committed a UMOC. Mm-hmm. How would that purchaser allege, you know, comply with the obligation to allege an unfair method of competition and to prove injury? I'm just trying to figure this out.
In that circumstance, as in the case that Mr. Bickerton discussed, where an employee actually lost his job because he was the unfair method of competition has led your friend to deal with you instead of dealing with the Apple Store or Best Buy or somebody else, and they have been injured because they bought a bum product because you were cheating vis-a-vis the other outlets for computers. Now that would create, it makes it somewhat complicated to talk about you as an individual compared to Best Buy going
ahead. What if I replaced a hard drive with something that was so much better than what was originally in there?
Then the question comes...
And it was brand new.
And then the question comes, was anyone damaged? And it's like, not only better, but more expensive and so forth. Then the question comes, could a consumer who ended up with the best computer in the world complain that they suffered damages by reason of your conduct? And they would have to say, gee, lucky me. I wasn't hurt by reason of what you did to me.
Okay.
And that's the problem. They were benefited. They maybe and going back to
let me just ask a follow up. Wouldn't the trial judge in that situation tell the jury, the fact finder, if you find that the defendant in this case substituted the hard drive, the court instructs you as a matter of law that you must find that the defendant engaged in an unfair method of competition, an unfair or deceptive act. Why wouldn't the court instruct the jury that way?
It could well do that.
And why wouldn't they do it in this case as well?
It could well do that, but the question is, were they damaged by reason of the unfair method of competition? Did they suffer loss by reason of that? And in the computer example, they would say, yes, you engaged in an unfair method of competition, but it didn't cause, no one suffered harm by reason of that unfair method of competition. And let me give you an example from a case this court decided some time ago, which is the Rawlings case. In the Rawlings case, a consumer came in and said, I am being chased by an unlicensed collector. And this court said, all true, but it was a valid debt. And so when you paid your debt, you can't complain that you were damaged by reason of the collector's violation of Chapter 480. And the same is true here. They weren't damaged by reason of that in Justice McKenna's
example.
I'm
not sure whether Mr. Gerbaugh would agree that he wasn't damaged.
Well, I would say yes, Mr. Gerbaugh would say he was damaged. But it wasn't. He wasn't damaged by the hotel's gathering lots of business. He was damaged by the hotel gathering the business and then violating Chapter 388, and being damaged by a violation of Chapter 388 isn't the same as being damaged by reason of the unfair competition. And going back, and this is tied into Justice Acopa's example, where you have an industry where everybody's cheating. I think the fact that if everybody, every market participant is cheating, that would not prevent one market participant from standing up and saying, you cheated me out of being able to host Bill Gates' wedding, which would have made me billions. They could still stand up and say that. The response from the bad actor might be, you're guilty of unclean hands, but that's not a defense in a 480 claim. So I think that every market participant could complain, even if they themselves might have unclean hands.
I don't think the law, though, would countenance a situation like that, because that would be the legislature affording a right, and because of the violation of the law, precluding a remedy. And I don't think this court or any court would apply the law in that way. I just wanted to ask you, and I know you've gone over this and read into, by reason of anything forbidden, the necessity of having a reduction in competition. But just looking at the plain language of 13, it says, any person who is injured in the person's business or property by reason of anything forbidden or declared unlawful by this chapter may sue for damages. So if the legislature has deemed that the failure to disclose is an unfair method of competition, then the person injured need not prove that it's an unfair method of competition. And if the injury obviously is the loss of income, in this case tip income, it seemed fairly clear on the face of the statute is that the loss of tip income was by reason of anything, i.e. the 481B requirement that there be disclosure, forbidden or declared unlawful. And the failure to disclose would be something forbidden or unlawful?
If we were here and trying to persuade you that there was no remedy under Chapter 388 and no remedy under 480-2 and 13, we would be in precisely the dilemma that you described for us. But we are not. We're here in a situation where it is not the lack of disclosure that caused the harm. It's the failure to comply with 388 that caused the harm.
Yes, but but what you have precluded is any remedy under 480 when the legislature has said expressly that for a violation of 481B, you have a remedy under 482, mm-hmm. 480-2.
Only if you can establish the causal link between the misconduct and the damages. We're not suggesting a reading that writes out any remedy for anybody by linking 480 and 481B14. We acknowledge that there are remedies for some people. It is just not a remedy for someone who has the benefit of Chapter 388 and the right to immediate payment and full payment of the entire charge, which is what these people have.
That's right. Your theory would exclude, consumers, because consumers don't have a remedy under 388.
No, you know, consumers don't have a remedy under 388, but consumers...
So then their only remedy would be under 480.
Correct, if they can demonstrate that they suffered some economic harm.
So if we're to be consistent, then your remedy would preclude, your construction of the statute would preclude people who the legislature said would have a remedy under 482.
Well, the legislature didn't say necessarily that every employee would have a remedy, didn't say at all that every remedy would have,
said any
every employee
person.
would have a remedy. It does. And any person who is injured in the way that Chapter 480.
But why isn't it a rational reading of the statute to say employees get double damages, but those employees who can show an effect on competition are entitled to treble damages, and that their injury flowed from or resulted from that conduct which negatively affected competition? In this case, the argument would be misleading consumers, so they spend for a product that they don't get what they thought they were getting.
Well, I'm not sure that...
Why isn't that irrational? In other words, your interpretation of the statute is 388 is exclusive remedy. Employees at that hotel are out of the box. Why isn't there another interpretation, which is 388 is a remedy, and employees at that hotel can get the additional remedy of treble damages if they can show an effect on competition, which the plaintiffs argue they were able to do through their expert witnesses in this case?
Well, their experts didn't actually do that. Their experts talked about theories and not facts, which is why Judge Sakamoto properly rejected their opinions. But again, the difficulty is that the damage to the employees doesn't flow from the way the hotel competed against others. It flowed from the fact that they didn't pay when 388 required it. Now remember, under 481B, there could be a hotel that gives absolutely nothing to the employees, and if that's disclosed, the employees are just out of luck. But if they are injured because of the lack of disclosure, I would suggest that the remedy is not under 480, not giving them all the service charge. That's a 388 remedy. At best, the remedy would be saying they lost the opportunity to have generous patrons or generous customers give more. And it might be possible for somebody to say, gee, if you had disclosed I wasn't getting all of it, notwithstanding the fact I have a right under 388 to get all of it, Mr. Bill Gates, for example, would have given us a bigger tip. He would have given us a tip at all. And then that's perhaps the kind of injury that the worker at the hotel that cheated to get the business could claim. Because the legislature is clearly concerned not about getting all the service charge into the hands of the employees, but about depriving the employees of the opportunity to get a tip from somebody who says you're only getting 85% of the service charge. I want you to get more. I want you to get 150% of the service charge, and here's some more money. That's the kind of harm that the legislature was concerned about in addressing and creating the remedy under 481B14. It wasn't concerned about not getting the service charge itself. It was depriving them of the opportunity to get tips above and beyond. And so I would submit that if you say we have to find a remedy for injury for employees of the Pacific Beach who are harmed by this practice, then the damages are not the balance of the service charge. It's whatever they might have earned if they can produce appropriate evidence from people who wanted to give them higher tips once they learned that 15% was being shared with the pastry chef and the assistant pantry man and other people who made the event a success. It seems to me it defies logic to suggest that a happy bride who loves her wedding cake wouldn't like to see, you know, some of the service charge shared with the pastry chef. They say that's wrong and that's not permitted, that they wouldn't like to have it shared with the catering manager who put it all together and came up with the great theme. It, you know, that's all something that the statute allows.
The happy bride usually pays separately for the cake.
Maybe. And they'd like to give a tip on top of that, I'm sure.
Well, maybe on that note, is there anything further, Mr. Austin? We've gone quite a bit over
time.
No, I
know you have, and I appreciate the additional time.
Okay, thank you very much. Mr. Bickerton?
Thank you. It's gratifying to see so much interest from the bench in this issue. We've certainly had great interest in this issue. I've written the amicus brief in Milan, for example, and Mr. Perkin and Ms. Freer worked on the amicus brief in Davis. There are some simple answers to the points that Mr. Alston raises. First of all, I do want to stress I have never sought quintuple damages. That is a figment of Mr. Alston's imagination. Perhaps it's what he fears, but the Liebert case, Liebert versus Fernandez, is very clear. In that case, you had to choose between punitive and treble, where you had both. You don't get to accumulate in that sense. So it's an election. And that's all we seek here is that election. I'm reminded by his argument of the old joke about the guy who says, well, we lose a nickel on every deal, but we make up for it on volume. That is Mr. Alston's argument as to why they're not harmed by the effect on competition, because, you know, we get more work for these workers. We can, you know, clip 15% off each function, but they're getting to do more functions. You know, the record shows that Mr. Gerbot quit at the Pacific Beach Hotel. One reason he could be a class representative is because he didn't work there anymore. Otherwise, there would be retaliation, we think. But he quit because he was tired. Okay, he's not like some of us who regrettably may have to retire at a certain age and we're still ready to go. They work them hard. And for Mr. Alston to come and now say that they're not damaged because, God, they got to do more functions at which we could clip 15% of their justified and rightful wages, is frankly offensive. But let me address the substance of what he said. He said that, we've got this, he's really raising a standing issue. And you actually decided this question in Davis, okay? The employee gets to bring a 480 claim. That was decided. The causation question is different. I frankly subscribe to the analysis of Justice Sokoba, and I think if you look at it, plain language of the statute, we don't need to bring Mr. Tattybouet or Mr. Brubaker forward because it has been declared to be an unfair method of competition. What Mr. Alston is saying is, touch your ear.
If that were the case, why would there be a double damages remedy and a treble damages remedy?
Well,
is there nothing additional that needs to be shown to get the benefit of the consumer protection or?
There is, and you identified it in Davis. We must identify the nature of the competition to distinguish between a UMOC and a UDAP, because all UDAPs can be UMOCs. And therefore, here's the problem. Who do you want to give standing to sue? In Justice McKenna's hypothetical, in the computer hypothetical, One fact that you could have injected is that it wasn't your friend that you sold the computer to. It was your friend's company. Now, your friend could bring a UDAP claim, and he doesn't need to go through this complex, the very complex notion that Judge Sakamoto read out of Davis, which we don't think is in there. He doesn't even have to go through the simple notion that is in Davis of identifying the nature of the competition. He can just go straight to it under the UDAP section. But the legislature says, well, you know, we like this UDAP approach, and we want other people besides consumers to have it. How are we going to achieve that? How are we going to give them that short, direct path to the treble damages? We will deem certain things to be UDAPs and UMOCs, because everyone has standing to bring a UMOC, and therefore companies can bring, another hotel can bring it, a worker can bring it, but it's going to work the same way the UDAP works, because we've deemed it so. We don't do that very often. We choose select cases where it's necessary for public policy reasons and we want to make sure it can happen. That's when we do the deeming. So that's what's done. Now, Mr. Alston has a, I'm going to go back and tell him that he's going to be, so, Mr. Gerbot is going to be so happy when I tell him he has not been harmed, because in Villon you declared a right under Chapter 388. He'll be thrilled. Of course, he'll say, where's the money? But I'll have to say, well, that's okay. You've got a right now that you didn't have before. Aren't you thrilled? It's frankly a silly argument. He could get up here and say, you know what? You shouldn't get treble damages under 480 for unfair and deceptive practices. You know why? Because you already have a fraud remedy. The law doesn't work that way. The law doesn't say no harm flows within the meaning of Chapter 480-13, Section 480-13's requirement that there be injury as a result of. You can't say, well, you don't have an injury because you've got another statute giving you a remedy. What would he have argued 2 months ago before Villon? I mean, he's just making it up as he goes along. You cannot say that the fact that you've got remedy A means remedy B is excluded. The law doesn't work that way. In the Liebert case is that example. People had fraud and punitive damages, and they had treble damages, and they had to make a decision. And actually, you don't have to make the decision until after judgment in those cases. You can look and see which one turned out better.
Mr. Bickerton, I let Mr. Alston go a bit over, and I've let you go a while too, but at some point,
I really think that I've said what I need to say, and I think that the points that I've made, hopefully, they're the best I can make, so I have nothing further to add. If there are no questions, I will submit.
Very well. Thank you very much to both of our counsel today. The court will take this matter under advisement.